I'm Jason Lewis.
I'm Flora Gladwin.
And I'm Thomas Mills.
Welcome to Climate Optimists. As a group of concerned citizens, we're on a journey to explore climate solutions and ways that each of us can make a difference.
And if you're a regular listener of the podcast and value what you get from us, consider joining our community of monthly supporters. You can feel good knowing you're helping empower people around the world to make a difference on climate. If you're already a supporter, thank you. As a nonprofit, your contributions are the reason we're here. And as a reminder, we also want to hear from you. So if you've taken action lately to help the climate, have questions or comments, drop us a note on our website or on social. And thanks to those who have. We appreciate you and your feedback.
As we've been mentioning in our last few episodes, we're shifting podcasts to a spring and fall season. To make sure that you don't forget about us, head over to our website and sign up to the monthly newsletter. And in addition, make sure that you're actually subscribed to us on your podcasting platform. And this will ensure that you get notified anytime a new episode comes out.
Good reminder, Thomas. Just head over to the website. It's easy. And you get a short and succinct newsletter each month in the time when the podcast is off. So the truth is, we're in the midst of a global energy transformation that's occurring at a scale that, frankly, can be hard to wrap your head around. Solar energy is at the forefront of that transformation. Last year, enough solar was installed globally to cover roughly 2 million acres, or 700,000 hectares for our European and Australian counterparts. And while that's amazing, we're going to have to install solar at an even more rapid pace to hit global climate targets. So today, we're going to talk about the state of the solar market and the challenges we need to address to allow it to reach its full potential. But before we go there, let's talk about this week's reason for hope.
Thanks, Jason. While we are talking solar today, this week's positive news comes from the wind industry. And according to the Global Wind Energy Council report, 117 gigawatts of wind were installed last year, and that's a 50% increase from 2022. China led the way with 69 gigawatts, but to meet the climate targets that we have in front of us, annual installations need to grow rapidly to at least 320 gigawatts year on year before 2030.
Yeah, it's exciting, you know, to see that both wind and solar are on this rapid growth trajectory. But it is crazy that we're breaking records at the rate that we are, and we still need to install more in order to meet climate targets. Even after being in the renewable energy industry for years, it's hard to wrap your head around how quickly this is taking place.
But I think to put that into perspective, though, you think back to a big year when we used to work in the US, and the big year for the US like 10 years ago was maybe 6 gigawatts of installed capacity a year. And now China is doing more than 10 times that a year. So really, it is quite phenomenal how rapidly things have expanded.
Yeah, I mean, amongst, you know, obviously the challenges we're facing with climate change and what can feel like, you know, rough news out there, this is definitely a bright spot.
Well, with that, let's introduce today's guest. Bill Eddy co-founded One Energy Renewables in 2009. With a mission to fight climate change by making clean energy the number one electricity choice for consumers and utilities. Bill currently serves as Vice President of Corporate Development, focused on developing new strategies for the company and structuring renewable energy transactions between One Energy's solar projects and its customers. Prior to starting One Energy, he practiced environmental and energy law, handling utility cases, environmental permitting, water rights, and other matters.
Bill, welcome to Climate Optimists.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start you off with the question we do all our guests. When it comes to efforts to address climate change, what makes you hopeful?
Sure, yeah. What makes me hopeful? I have a couple of kids that are, you know, college age, and I would say, yeah, the current generation is very motivated and very aware, from what I've seen, about climate change, and they kind of have an activist mentality, which I really appreciate, and a desire to affect change. So yeah, the current generation, I think they're all right. Definitely make me optimistic about the future. And then secondly, I'm optimistic because of the pace of change on especially renewable energy, deployment of solar around the world. Obviously still a long way to go, but definitely makes me optimistic that there are solutions that are working and are being deployed at very significant scales.
Yeah, I agree. It's nice to see things are happening, albeit maybe not as fast as we would like. The scale of change is pretty massive at this point. Well, since, you know, our topic is solar, let's dive into kind of like how much solar are we forecast to install, let's say this year in the US, and maybe to the extent that you can put that in the context of kind of average homes, I think that might be helpful for folks to visualize.
Yeah, for sure. You know, we look to a couple of different sources in the US for our, you know, domestic forecast of how much is going to be put in the ground. That would be the Energy Information Administration, which is part of the federal government, as well as SEIA, Solar Energy Industries Association. And we're targeting, you know, north of, in the range of 35 gigawatts, 30,000 megawatts of solar capacity installed this year. And that was coming off of 32 gigawatts last year. What do those numbers mean? It depends on where the solar is and what kind of home that you're serving effectively. But it's in the range of 5 million homes worth of energy, you know, last year, with more coming on this year. You could call it 4.5 to 5 million. And that math is basically how much total kilowatt hours a home typically consumes and how many kilowatt hours a solar megawatt typically produces. And that's what you get. Now, I will say one thing that's very interesting and not maybe entirely explainable about this industry is it is routinely under forecast. So all these forecast numbers need to be heavily caveated.
Well, I guess for those of us who are wanting to see us decarbonize more quickly, I guess that's the right kind of error we'd want to see. And five, you know, 4 or 5 million homes is a lot. Do you have a sense, if we were to sort of expand, zoom out and look more at a global scale, kind of what numbers we're dealing with there?
So yeah, internationally, we're looking at a few, you know, key countries or regions that are going to be the drivers of the bulk of the new capacity additions. And the IEA, International Energy Agency, for 2024 is pointing to at least about 270 gigawatts, approaching 10 times what the US is going to put in.
Wow.
And that's a lot of that's in China. So roughly 160 gigawatts in China. That's 5+ times what the US is putting in the ground. 47 gigawatts in Europe, you know, another 50% over what we're doing. 21 gigawatts in India, 8 in Brazil, et cetera. So, you know, your total worldwide additions will likely fall in the range of 275 to 300 gigawatts, which is really awesome. And what's really even more awesome is that the industry, the manufacturing base, is ready to serve that. And predominantly okay. That is coming from China and Southeast Asia. Due to the Inflation Reduction Act, we are definitely going to see some addition of U.S. manufacturing here of solar panels and other solar equipment. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of that manufacturing is in China and Southeast Asia right now.
So in terms of cell production, mostly Asia could evolve or will evolve because of some of the tax structure things we've done with Inflation Reduction Act. I suspect, you know, maybe some of the same in Europe. But I'm assuming downward, you know, trend is still downward when it comes to cost of cells, right? I mean, there's been, I know, a big drop in the price of cells. I don't know if we're kind of getting the bottom of that curve or kind of where things stand.
Yeah, it is tough to forecast. I mean, the overall history of the cost of each, you know, watt of solar panel capacity is incredibly downward. You know, when I started looking at solar, it was north of $1 per watt. That's, you know, more than 10 years ago. Before COVID, before the supply chain disruptions, we were getting to about 30 cents a watt, and then it ticked up a little bit. So there was a bump from COVID, but from the supply chain disruptions, you know, in that time period, bumped up into maybe the 40s, 40 cents per watt. But now we're back, and with a seemingly downward projection into the 20 cents to 30 cent range. And, you know, it is a commodity, if you will. Like, a solar panel is not a custom manufactured product. They manufacture just tons and tons of the same unit. Those can go to lots of different, you know, projects. And because like any commodity, for that reason, you will see price variability and some amount of price volatility, just depending on what's happening in the world, right? You know, it could be a shipping, could be a labor situation, could be an upstream supply situation. But, you know, at this point, that's kind of what we're looking at in the future, is a good buyer, a large buyer of solar panels can pay in the range of 20 to 30 cents per watt for a utility scale project. So, you know, multi-megawatt project.
That's pretty crazy drop when you think about, just, you're saying roughly a decade to see that sort of, you know, drop in price, especially considering, you know, you said with the supply chain disruptions of COVID.
Yep. Been great to watch and be a part of, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads into sort of another question I had, which is, you know, we see these really big numbers in terms of solar installation today. How has the market been evolving, you know, over the last couple of years, like upward trajectory, you know, what kind of growth are we seeing?
Right. Well, I mean, I work for One Energy Renewables, and we are a national developer of utility scale solar projects and community solar projects. Most of what we do is multi-megawatt. So picture a property size or a project size of at least about 8 or 10 acres, going up to hundreds of acres. And so that's, you know, that's our lived experiences in that part of the market. And we just see tremendous opportunity, and really trying to, I would almost triage and figure out the best opportunities for us to pursue, because you honestly can sit and make a business case that one should try to develop solar project virtually anywhere in the US. And within that spectrum, you know, there's places where you can make more money at it, where it's more needed, where it's easier. But solar is really happening basically in every state. And we just see tremendous opportunity. We're seeing utility counterparties who perhaps 3 to 5 years ago were interested but reluctant, or interested but planning to do something 5 or 10 years from now in solar, they are now wanting to do things now. So there's a lot more buyer side ambition, I would say, to add solar. In addition to utilities, we're seeing a lot of direct interest from big corporate buyers. This has been happening over the last, I would say, 5 to 8 years, but the advent of big data center operators like Google's and Amazon's and Facebook's wanting to buy solar and wind directly and actually doing it at scale. So those are your two big, you know, chunkiest demand sources are obviously utilities and then sophisticated industrial buyers that can work with us directly. And then you see a large growth in certain places in community solar. And community solar is defined different ways around the country, but the essence of it is a way for example, someone who lives in a condo or an apartment or a business that's in an office building to participate in a solar project, to effectively buy solar and get some of the benefits that someone who has a nice big south-facing roof can get doing themselves. So community solar typically means a way for you to buy solar through your electric bill in some way, usually save a little bit of money in doing so and get to support a solar project. And we've seen really significant growth in the community solar space, the community solar markets. Not every state allows this by law, but many do, and really, you know, really big parts of the market allow community solar.
So community solar really, I mean, could include anybody that wants to be a part of a solar project. It sounds like kind of a pooling of resources and you know, acquiring that project and then having it serve a local market. Is that kind of
correct?
What I'm understanding?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, every state does community solar just a little bit differently, but a typical formulation is the state will allow projects up to about 2 megawatts in size. Sometimes it's 3 megawatts or even 5. to connect to a utility distribution grid and basically be accepted into the community solar program for a regulatory treatment as a community solar project and to sell its power to households or small businesses or even big businesses and municipalities, et cetera. So, but that's kind of typically how it looks, you know, a 2 to 5 megawatt project that's connected to the grid in your same electric service territory. So here in Portland, you know, most of the city is covered by Portland General Electric. And there is a community solar program in Oregon, which allows you to basically source, you know, a fraction of your energy from a solar project down as far as about Salem, Oregon, and up to Portland. So
it's almost more of like a, I don't know if it's a fair analogy, but kind of like the farmer's market style where you're kind of buying locally, buying your energy locally, coming from maybe a smaller producer.
Correct.
Within that, you know, that radius.
Yeah, very similar.
So market, you know, positive things happening, you know, big growth. How, I mean, within the context of the U.S. market, how has the Inflation Reduction Act played into that?
The Inflation Reduction Act has been a real sea change for the industry generally. And I say this kind of tongue in cheek, but the law is actually having the intended result. And okay. The intended result, at least the parts that affect, you know, my company most directly, were to help steer clean energy investment to places that economically need it the most, and to steer manufacturing investment to the United States. And thirdly, to create, you know, good paying jobs in the clean energy sector. To get the base level of tax credit, you have to commit and contract to use prevailing wage employees. Workers on the site.
Oh, okay.
So if you don't do that, you get a much, much lower tax credit. And the whole industry has repositioned around using prevailing wage. So that was a really big deal and definitely helps to create a more sustainable, you know, living wage, good paying jobs industry around deployment of solar. And then you are eligible as a project owner to get slightly higher levels of tax credit under a couple of different pathways. The ones that I'll mention, because there actually are a few, but the ones I'll mention are, one, if you can use domestically sourced content, like manufactured products in your project, you can get an enhanced tax credit.
Okay.
Or call it a bonus tax credit. And right now in solar, there are some projects that are getting the bonus tax credit, but the industry is still limited by the amount of solar panels that are manufactured here. So luckily we're seeing lots of announced solar panel manufacturing factories. I just saw an announcement the other day, Qcells, which is part of a large Korean company that makes solar panels internationally, started getting panels off their factory line in Georgia, the state of Georgia. Not the Republic of Georgia. And so that was great to see. And that'll mean more projects that are going in the ground, you know, can get that extra tax credit. The other way to get an enhanced tax credit by developing projects in so-called energy communities. And it basically means you get a higher tax credit if you are building your project in a community that has a fossil fuel plant that has closed in the community in recent years. And likewise, communities that have a combination of both relatively high fossil fuel employment to begin with and have a unemployment rate higher than the national average can also get that enhanced tax credit.
So it sounds like multiple levers that came out, you know, to incentivize solar in the IRA, and everything from, you know, prevailing wage to domestic manufacturing to, it's really interesting, you know, targeting these communities that are maybe in transition or set to be in transition.
Correct.
And trying to provide them with some jobs. So, you know, we talked price a little bit earlier. I know there was a time when, you know, people said, well, hey, you know, renewables are more expensive and, you know, costly to deploy. The economics have obviously changed a lot.
Yep.
Wondering if you could give us sort of a general sense of where does the cost of solar, you know, or solar plus, you know, energy storage compared to, you know, our other kind of classic forms of,
yeah,
like fossil generation.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, to start the cost profile discussion, obviously there are big caveats around where is this project and, you know, what are its land costs? Every project is going to be its own special snowflake, but, you know, looking at the industry as a whole and averaging out across multiple regions, I would point listeners to a report that comes out every year from Lazard. So Lazard has, for utility scale projects, solar only, a levelized cost of energy between $30 and $41 per megawatt hour. The units, you know, just remember 30 to 41 for solar PV photovoltaics. Comparing that to what Lazard says for the most typical thing that would also be going into the grid these days that's not renewables would be a gas combined cycle project. So that's a natural gas fired power plant. But for a gas combined cycle project, they peg it as 45 to 74. So solar, 30 to 41, gas, 45 to 74. Coal stepping up much higher, you know, 65 to the 150s. So that's the high level comparison. I think that's part of the reason that we're seeing, you know, utilities across the board starting to just say yes to solar and putting in their plans and actually doing it, because skeptics in the audience will say the solar output on a day-to-day basis, hour-to-hour, it's not the same as a gas plant or a coal plant.
Right.
At the same time, at that price, as a utility, a lot of the utilities just say, I'll take all I can get of $30 energy. Okay? Right. And you'll have utilities with a different need and a different perspective on solar and how much it really helps them. But you definitely see those utilities who have peak needs driven by air conditioners and peak needs driven by irrigation, they really stepped up to the plate for solar and continue to do so because it matches well with their need.
That makes sense. So different utilities, different kind of load profiles and trying to, you know, best serve that. And so sounds like everybody's getting on the solar wagon, but maybe some, you know, more quickly than others.
Yeah.
Wondering just briefly for those who are, you know, kind of looking at this from the outside and obviously know what a solar panel is and maybe you've seen a solar, you know, farm out there. What are kind of the characteristics you look for in a kind of a good solar site? And I know you've talked a little bit to some of these, but wondering if you kind of outline, like, you know, what are the top criteria that you're looking for an ideal solar site?
Sure. Yeah. The key ones are going to be access to the grid, meaning, you know, both that we can interconnect to a power line that is of a size that is relevant to our project size. So that's the first thing. Second thing is permittability. Are there zoning limitations? Are there natural resource environmental characteristics of the site that would say, you know, whoever's in charge of giving us a permit, can we get to a yes? Like in Texas, literally there is no local permitting in most places. And that is not the case in California or most of the coastal states. So grid access, permittability. And then when you get into a cost profiling, there are some nitty-gritties that can really result in surprising economic changes for a project. So what is the ground like? What foundations or driven piles are acceptable? What we like is to be able to take a steel, you know, pile, a steel beam, and drive that into the ground 8 to 10 feet, and that's the foundation. No concrete, no pre-drilling, no nothing. And topography, just slopes. So, you know, we definitely want to be on flatter sites, more level, or slightly south facing. But yeah, topography is important. So
that gives people kind of a snapshot of the things that, you know, you're considering as a developer. And obviously we're facing a good economic environment. What are kind of the challenges, the things that are maybe getting in the way of solar being able to ramp up even more quickly?
I've got a few. How much time do you have? seriously, there's the three big challenges that we're facing are interconnection to the grid, transmission through the grid, and getting permits. So I'll take those in order and kind of state of play. Interconnection means the process of asking the utility or whoever owns the power lines, you're going to interconnect this amount of generator, solar, wind, whatever, and they answer back, is it safe? What do you have to do to interconnect? What facilities or changes may need to be built so that you can do that in a safe and reliable fashion? So there is a log jam, if you will, a traffic jam of generators trying to connect to the grid. A lot of it is solar, a lot of it is battery and wind, and it's just a lot of work. So interconnection is a big challenge. Transmission is really a separate question, although it's related. You know, transmission is about, you know, can energy that's being generated flow to where it's needed? Right. And so in the Northwest, you know, we have a kind of a classic, very macro problem, which is most of the energy is used on the I-5 corridor, you know, Seattle down to Portland for the most part. Most of the energy is generated on the east side of the mountains, hydro, wind, increasingly solar. And so that energy has to flow from east to west, and it has to go across beautiful mountains. You're just going to have a really hard time building a new transmission corridor. You're going to cross tribal lands. You're going to cross national forests. You're going to encounter endangered species. To really fulfill the full benefits of what the Inflation Reduction Act can bring, we just need to invest in transmission. So the third one I mentioned was permits. And, you know, permitting has definitely become more difficult. Increasingly, we do see permits being contested. Often it's either someone nearby that doesn't want to look at the project. Sometimes we hear about, oh, solar is taking away farmland. You know, we really fundamentally disagree that it's taking away that farmland, because there's other things you can do, and I'll get to that. We may hear that, oh, property values are going to be diminished for people living nearby. Again, the economic studies that have addressed this really don't bear that out. But, you know, we want to be a great member of the community. You know, we don't want to build a project in a community that doesn't want us. We want to hear the challenges, hear the concerns, and address them. In regard to farmland, you know, we are very active in incorporating the concept of agrivoltaics, so doing some farming within a solar project boundary. I mean, the most obvious and common one is sheep grazing. And it's just a great co-use because the sheep are, you know, they're not disruptive to the solar project at all. In fact, we need to make sure the solar project is very tightly put together and doesn't have like a lot of loose wires and things that they like to rub up against or chew on, but very commonly done. And so we're not taking that farmland out of agricultural production. We're adding a use, solar farming. We're continuing sheep grazing on the ground, and it's just an enhanced use. It's not a industrialization.
Yeah, it's cool to see that evolving. So as we're talking about this and the potential barriers, probably limited things in some cases that us as individuals can do, but wondering, you know, for all of us who want to see more solar out there, more renewables and see it more quickly, what can each of us do to really help accelerate, you know, the growth of solar? Yep.
I think the best things you can do to help support solar, first off, choose solar as a buyer if you can. And what I mean is, if you can participate in a community solar program in your utility, do it. If your utility offers a solar energy product, a rate that is solar oriented, you can choose that. Try it out. If you have a roof that's well suited, obviously you can see what the financials look like. And a lot of places, you know, it will be a savings to put solar on your roof if you have a well suited. But choose it as a buyer when you can, and then vote solar. Candidates will have a position. There are definitely, you know, candidates that are more forward leaning about wanting to support the industry and keep growing clean industry in the U.S. and just encourage you to look at them and support them.
I think that makes sense. Well, Bill, appreciate you coming on the podcast, sharing your knowledge with us, and, you know, of course, for all the work that One Renewables is doing to help advance solar in the U.S.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Well, Thomas, Flora, what were your takeaways from the discussion with Bill?
We clearly need to increase transmission. In fact, a Princeton-led project called Repeat says we need to double our transmission capacity if we want to reap the full benefits of the Inflation Reduction Act, with a stat that says that we could lose over 80% of the potential emissions reductions from the act if we constrain transmission expansion to the rate that it's growing at now. But it's not an easy thing to change, and that leads to the second challenge with getting connected to the grid. There are currently thousands of clean energy projects stuck waiting for permitting approval. According to Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, less than a fifth of wind and solar proposals actually make it through the so-called interconnection queue. So Bill is right. It doesn't matter how favorable solar is or how fast it's growing if we can't get it connected.
Yeah, clearly addressing, you know, both the transmission constraint and permitting, you know, is key to being able to realize our climate targets. Thomas, what about thoughts from your end?
I think when we're looking at this utility level solar, it's very important to keep in mind that those hurdles that we create with transmission, I think often don't need to be there if we just put these transmission lines underground. I look at what, you know, Europe's doing and has been doing ever since they had a number of large ice storms back in the early 2000s. They were like, bugger it, we're putting this stuff underground. It has much lower ongoing costs. There's less strategic risk. There's less ice impact or storm impact risk. You don't have to worry about wildfires. And according to the US Department of Energy, it does cost about 4 to 10 times more to put these transmission lines underground from the outset, but they have much lower ongoing risk and operational costs, and people don't have to look at them. Like, people's beef with these things, although nobody really wants to say, I just don't like the look of the transmission lines, that really is the number one issue, right? But nobody wants to say that because it all looks so superficial and you're getting in the way of us stopping the planet from burning just because you don't like the look of transmission lines. So they'll find any other excuse possible to stop these from going ahead. So let's just bite the bullet and accept that it is going to be a little bit more expensive. There is going to be a cost associated with this transition of renewable energy, and put the stuff underground.
Yeah, I think when you consider how much transmission we have to put in and where we have to put it in, being able to put it underground deals with that number one barrier, which is obviously, you know, landowner pushback. And, you know, the reality is, I don't know about in Australia, but, you know, here in the US, you've got big utilities now that are moving some of their transmission underground to deal with the risk of wildfire. So, you know, even independent of needing to have more transmission, I think there's a recognition that with the risk of wildfire and with other climate related disasters, it makes sense to have that stuff underground. And I think it's worth stepping back too, as we're talking about all this, you know, these constraints, to just keep in mind what we're trying to accomplish here. You know, practically speaking, we need to halve our CO2 emissions by 2030. You know, that means roughly, you know, tripling our renewable energy capacity by 2030, which is huge. And so we need to be thinking about how do we remove barriers, right? Not put additional ones in place. And so I think, you know, it's incumbent upon all of us as folks who want, you know, as folks who are concerned about the climate crisis, to be embracing, you know, renewables, be embracing, you know, additional transmission, ensuring that we help ramp up energy efficiency. And I think in all of this, we just want to maintain an awareness that all energy has a footprint. We have this transformation we need to, you know, take place. And the way that we as individuals can guarantee that that transformation is successful is by being supportive in our local communities.
And I think that's a good pivot towards, you know, what we can do as individuals on the solar front is get solar installed on any rooftop area that you have access to. And that might be at your work because you can convince your work to do it, at your home. Like here in Australia now, 1/3 of houses have solar PV systems installed. And to me, what that says is that we've got 2/3 of the way to go. We've got a lot of spare roof area we can still be using because you've got that infrastructure there anyway that you were going to maintain regardless, let's just get solar on the roof. And it's really not that difficult. And then the other part of it is that if you are doing solar now in any part of the world where the pricing goes negative in the middle of the day because there's too much solar going onto the grid, it's about time you started thinking about installing a battery with the solar system, because the majority of us are using that power in the early morning and the afternoon when our solar is not generating at its maximum levels.
If you have a, you know, if you have a roof that you can put solar on, that's great. If you don't, you know, as Bill talked about, there's the ability to participate, at least in many places in the US, in what's called community solar. And all it really takes is becoming a like a subscriber at your local utility that, you know, allows you to purchase shares effectively in that project. Those shares are based on your usage. And then what you're doing is you're in essence paying your, you know, that solar provider for credits based on how much that project produces. And then that those credits offset your utility bill. And switching over to community solar can save you an average of 5 to 20% on your electricity bill.
Well, that's a good segue into what we can do to help accelerate the expansion of solar. Our first option is to get involved in supporting solar and related transmission projects planned in your area. Having supportive voices is a critical part of helping to ensure that these projects move forward and in turn ensure that we are actually able to hit and maintain incredibly important climate targets.
Yeah, and the second option is if you're wanting to, you know, ensure you're buying energy from the sun, as Thomas put it, you know, put solar on your rooftop. And if you're not in a place where that's an option, sign up for that community solar program. We can all be, you know, purchasing electrons from the sun at this point. There's no excuse.
And if you have got rooftop area available, but it's not perfect, don't stress so much about that. If you buy a modern inverter from any of the leading manufacturers, these inverters have got smarts on board them that allows the inverter to work out when one panel is shaded, adjust for that. And so you only lose the production from that one panel that is shaded. So don't worry about perfection anymore. Good enough is adequate. Get the panels on, get them generating, start contributing to the solution.
Well, that's a wrap for this week's episode. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. Our next episode will be dropping on May 7th. It will be our last before our fall season that begins in September. And as Thomas mentioned earlier, we do want to stay connected. So take the 1 or 2 minutes max. You've already listened to us rant for 40. Head over to our website and sign up for our newsletter. It's a timely look at climate solutions, challenges, and of course, reasons for hope. Climate Optimists is made possible by Climate Stewards Collective. You can find us on the web at climateoptimist.co. And don't forget to follow us on social at Climate Optimist Podcast.